On Thursday, the 15th of May, The Spectator is hosting a live book club event. Sam Leith, the host of this podcast, will be joined by former Telegraph editor-in-chief and military historian Max Hastings. It will be an opportunity to talk about Max's new book, Sword, D-Day, Trial by Battle, as well as mark the 80th anniversary of VE Day. The full details are as follows. 7:30 on Thursday the 15th of May at the Shaw Theatre in Euston, London, and tickets start from £27.50, although I believe there are ticket options that include a signed copy of the book. For those tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/bookslive. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and I'm very pleased to be joined this week by The Spectator contributor, the writer and campaigner Julie Bindle, whose new book is Lesbians, Where Are We Now? Julie, I mean, you've supplied your own question. Where are you now?
Well, we're in a very different position in many ways than when I came out in the late 1970s, when I was still a teenager. Things are better in many ways, legislatively, and I think in the public consciousness, certainly in the West, but we're in a much worse position in some ways also because of the last few years of the rising tide of misogyny, of woman-hating, which impacts lesbians, I argue in the book, a bit like the kind of sexism on steroids. So what happens to women, the sexism that women in general endure, experience in any society, is generally worse for lesbians because, of course, we're the only sexual orientation that excludes men. That's not why we're lesbians, but that is the case. And so where are we now? Well, we're in a stage of being attacked, but we're also, thankfully, at that point where many, many lesbians of all generations, and I'm pleased to say, in particular, younger lesbians, are fighting back and reasserting our rights, which we've unfortunately had to do.
Yeah. Well, can I start by going back a bit into history? Because, you know, you talk in the book very eloquently about the ways in which lesbians get a particularly hard time. But there is this idea with which you're quite impatient that seems to float around, that until the middle of the 20th century, lesbians didn't really get a hard time because, you know, Queen Victoria refused to believe they existed and therefore they weren't legislatively oppressed and everything was sort of in some way tickety-boo. Why is that idea lodged in people's heads and what's wrong about it?
Well, first of all, it's absolutely not true. Queen Victoria didn't say she didn't believe lesbians existed. There was a debate in the House of Lords where many of the male peers argued that lesbians shouldn't be legislated against, which of course did happen to gay men, to men having sex with other men, because it might give women some ideas. And there was some hilarious...
It would encourage them.
Well, quite. And also just put the idea on the map that this is a possibility. So there were some absolutely hilarious discussions and debates by these peers where they were saying, well, if we are to say it's illegal for two women to have sex, that's what they might do. And we know, don't we, boys, don't we, gentlemen, that when we go away, because this is obviously an upper class discussion, this didn't filter down to other groups of women. When we go away fighting in the army or on business, the fact that two women might share a bed is just a matter of comfort and friendship, isn't it? Or those two spinsters that live together do so because they haven't had the fortune to marry a man and settle down, and this is them keeping each other company. When in fact, of course, there were women having wild sexual flings and relationships with each other, and they were also married because, of course, marriage was compulsory. And so, therefore, we didn't get criminalised. However, the mythology is that that meant that lesbians were never legislated against until the 1980s, when Section 28 of the Local Government Act came into being, which was the first and only time that lesbians and gay men had ever been under scrutiny with the same law, which was that you couldn't promote positively the idea in certain local authority funded places, including schools, that homosexuality was in any way positive. So that wasn't true. What had happened was that lesbians were routinely, way before that time, picked up for cross-dressing, for example, were harassed if they were holding hands in the street or in clubs and nightclubs where they had to surreptitiously meet, and were criminalised through the back door. And the first thing that I ever did in a courtroom when I was, well, apart from that time I was picked up for shoplifting, which was a whole other story.
You do mention that in the book.
I do. That the first time I appeared in court as an observer, let's say, when I met the Women's Liberation Movement in the beginning of the 1980s, was to support lesbians who were in danger of having their children removed from them by ex-partners, by their former husbands, who just use the argument that these women were immoral and dangerous for children to be around because these women had left them for another woman. And so lesbianism was criminalised and it was punished, and there was never a law against women having sex with other women per se.
Well, I think that bears oddly, it seems to me, on an argument you make throughout the book and that becomes relevant again today, that you say a sort of, as it were, invisibility of lesbianism in law actually constituted a sort of erasure that did make it harder to organise, to understand your own sexuality, harder for people to come out.
It did. And I think the imagery of lesbians, certainly when I was growing up, was pretty horrific. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, there weren't very good role models for gay men. And, you know, it was that hyper camp, silly images,
sort of John Ingham,
exactly that, and also the kind of benevolent sexual predator. But for lesbians, it was grotesque women. I mean, the killing of Sister George is the first that comes to mind. Absolutely grotesque women who were very mentally deranged and who would stalk young, pretty, feminine women. And the actual lesbian was this mannish, blokish horror who would infect this straight feminine woman with this poison and turn her into a lesbian against her will. So it was very nasty. And of course, at the same time that you had these negative images and there were no positive ones until, and I would argue very strongly, Martina Navratilova appeared on our screens during Wimbledon, a tennis champion, who was outed as a lesbian in the very early 1980s, there was nothing for us to look at and think, oh, that might be nice. That's quite a nice life that woman's living. It's not so bad at all, is it? It was just horrific. At the same time, there were some men who were terribly excited at the idea of two women together, which is how the faux lesbian themed pornography began to become very popular, and today remains one of the most popular genres online. So on the one hand, you've got this idea, it's very, very sexy, these two women being together. And on the other hand, this awful public image. And whenever we were seen in the street, walking home from clubs or evenings out with our girlfriends, and again, I'm referring to the 1980s, there would be so many men either shouting that they were going to kick your head in, or, can you do a sex show for us, darling, in the back of my car? I mean, that was so regular, I can't even tell you. And it used to happen to all of my friends at the same time.
Well, there's that couple who were, I mean, it happened really recently, doesn't it? A couple who were beaten up on the bus for refusing to kiss.
That's right. That was not that long ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe. And it was a London bus, and they'd been on a night out, and a group of young men clocked them as lesbians and started demanding that they put on a display of that nature. So same old. But when they refused, of course, they did get beaten up. And actually, that happened to me when I was walking home in Brixton. It wasn't that I was asked to put on a sex show, that I was walking up on my own. So that would have been quite difficult. Actually, I'd have to be quite, I suppose, ambidextrous. But I was walking home in my mid-20s, and I don't know, you know, I don't conform, I don't wear makeup and feminine clothes and high heels. And maybe this bloke just decided that, you know, I needed a good talking to, and he started sexually harassing me verbally, and I told him in no uncertain terms to sling his hook. And the next thing, I had a broken nose and covered in blood, and it was just hideous. And this was literally because I'd spoken back to him. But having said that, that could have been any woman who refused to capitulate. And so whether it was anything to do with me being a lesbian or perceived as a lesbian is another issue, which of course then brings me to the point about how lesbians do get sexism and misogyny on steroids. At the same time, it's also used, the anti-lesbian slurs, the accusation of being a lesbian, is used against heterosexual women. Men will leap, I mean, abusive men. If you're in a pub or some place where they think that you're women together and they say, oh, hello, darling, you're on your own, and there's about six of you, and you say, well, we're not because we're all together, often they will leap from slags to lesbian very quick as an insult. And the term
I think you
lesbian,
said that was a 70s schoolyard.
That was a 70s schoolyard thing, but it also happened in pubs and nightclubs and other social settings where men would just trade one insult for the other, whichever was going to be the most offensive. And for straight women, it does act as a bit of a warning of, well, you know, if you're not putting out, if you're not being nice to men and flirting back to us when we try to pick you up, you know, we'll think of you as a lesbian, we'll call you a lesbian. And that is something that a lot of women really don't like.
In the early part of the book, you describe this extraordinary kind of conference at which Jill Johnston does this, I think you say, sort of unfettered by grammar or logic. But the vibes are very good. Can you talk about that and what that represented? Because it seems to me there's sort of interesting kind of subtleties within the idea of the wider women's movement and, you know, the emerging consciousness of lesbians at that time.
Yes, completely. Now, I didn't come out until the late 1970s. I watched a documentary in 1981 entitled Town Bloody Hall, which you can find on YouTube. It's amazing. But it was actually filmed in 1971. It took the filmmaker a decade to get the funding to get this done and dusted and distributed.
Was this D.A. Pennebaker?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
right. The Dylan guy.
Yes, an absolutely brilliant documentary. It was filmed in Manhattan, in the town hall, and it was the year that Jill Johnston brought out her book Lesbian Nation. And Jill used to write for The Village Voice, so she was a bit of a beatnik character, very well known in the village, was an out lesbian and very, very proudly out lesbian and very political about it, so insisting all women can be lesbians and the like. But great fun, apparently. I never met her. And this debate was chaired by Norman Mailer, who was known amongst the emerging women's liberation movement members as a pretty vile misogynist.
Yeah.
And, you know, nasty piece of work. Was it The Naked Ape? I think, I can't remember when he published The Naked Ape, but either way, deep misogyny. And the women who were speaking at this panel debating whether there should even be a women's
The Naked
liberation.
Ape was Desmond Morris, wasn't it? White Negro?
Do you know, I've got that completely wrong. But either way.
Barbara Shaw? Anyway.
So Norman Mailer was
The charge list is pretty well established.
Right, yes. He was a misogynist. And he was chairing this panel, which is extraordinary to think about it, although, you know, I've got no problem with it. Should there be a women's liberation movement? And there were some feminists, including Germaine Greer, and the other feminists were not that hard-hitting. Germaine Greer was quite funny. She was telling Norman Mailer that it was quite something that he was seen as a literary genius and women who wrote books that were very successful were described as female writers and that kind of backwards and forward stuff. And then Jill Johnston got on the stage to speak. And as you said, she spoke without any punctuation and she loved alliteration. And that's actually the style that she wrote Lesbian Nation in, which makes it both brilliant and difficult to read. And she gave this speech about all women are lesbians and all women should be lesbians. And basically, you know, men like Mailer are shits. And she overran her time and he tried to get her to stop. And you could just see him shrinking into himself and hating her being up on that stage because the other women had been quite conciliatory. Germaine Greer was even quite flirtatious with him, not Jill Johnston. And then eventually he shouted her down, said he was going to take the mic from her. And the audience were booing at him because she was so entertaining. There were the likes of Susan Sontag and others in the audience. And she just called her girlfriend up from the audience and they started kissing, and there was great whoops and cheering and some boos. And then they were joined by a third woman. I suppose the kids today would call it polyamory. But either way, there were three of them kissing on stage and rolling around, and Mailer was being so deeply offensive, using language that was grotesque to describe them. And it was a win-win for Jill Johnston. And I opened the book with the story of me watching that video 10 years after the debate in 1981, when I was a 19-year-old with a group of feminists and lesbians, and just thinking, oh my God, this is the most positive thing I have ever seen on a TV screen, on a big screen, that depicts lesbians. I'd never seen anything like it before. So it was a groundbreaking moment for me. And I think for many of other lesbians that saw that.
Well, it also gives on something that I'm really intrigued by in the book. It seems to be a theme of your argument that lesbianism is, at least, you know, as it were, under patriarchy, always more than just a sexual orientation. Can you expand on that idea a bit? Because I think that's very intriguing.
For the majority of lesbians, they want to live their lives, have no big plan in disrupting patriarchy, probably aren't even self-conscious feminists, and would be surprised if it were put to them that they are disruptive of the patriarchal norm. And that's fine. But in reality, those of us that have been campaigning as feminists and also to achieve lesbian liberation and to end the oppression of lesbians, we recognise where the disquiet about lesbians existing comes from. So obviously we are excluding men from our sexual and romantic lives, from our domestic life. It doesn't mean we don't have close male friends and family members, but certainly we are a threat because we're saying we don't need you. Also, we can raise children without you, and we don't want to have sex with you. And so obviously once you're past about 30 years old, you know, men stop caring about whether or not you want to have sex with them because you're over the hill. But it disrupts patriarchy not just because of their particular, I suppose, assumption that women, you know, want to settle down with them and certainly be intimate with them, but also because we're saying that the nuclear family, as made up by a man, a woman, and their children, is not the only model that can be successful. I think lesbians raise children largely very successfully. I think, and I'm certainly not suggesting that this is a better model, not in any way, but I think with the recognition that domestic violence and rape within familial contexts happens largely within that traditional nuclear family, and that often it can be a dangerous place for women and girls to either live or be raised, that it is sometimes for lesbians to think, actually, you know, we have many advantages. Yes, we are discriminated against, but there are many advantages also to living as lesbians with other women, because we don't have to concern ourselves with that level of domestic drudgery or the risk of violence, coercive control and abuse. So it's not that we go around thinking that this is a lesbian utopia and that all men have a propensity to violence and abuse, not at all. But we do tend to have more equal relationships.
You describe how, I mean, it's an idea that Jill Johnston floats and that you talk about, I think it's in Greenham, you know, a number of people, you know, changing team. In your view, is that a sort of response sometimes? And I know your work has dealt extensively with domestic violence and male violence against women, and that some of that is a sort of response to that trauma, or a realisation there's another easier, happier way to go?
That's a really good question. And I think our sexuality and our sexual attraction is hardwired very early on.
You do think
and I don't mean I do, but I don't think that there's a gay gene. We certainly would have found it by now. And I don't think that this is stamped through our DNA. And I don't think that we're born that way. I think that babies are born without a sexuality, and children, you know, prepubescent children should never be assumed to have or ascribed a sexuality.
Yeah. And that Freud would disagree, but he was wrong.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, girls at 9, 10, and certainly I include myself in this, can have crushes on other girls, but not in a sexual way for very young children. And I think that those two get merged together, as though a 9-year-old having a crush means that's a sexual response. And often it's something very different. So I don't believe in the gay gene, but I do think that sexuality and sexual responses are very hardwired. And I don't see why we should use the argument of the gay gene to say that conversion therapy is wrong. Conversion therapy is wrong because conversion therapy is wrong. And there's nothing wrong with being same-sex attracted and living that life. But I don't think that you have to argue the, well, I was born fancying the midwife, to say, don't try to change us. Just don't try to change us. We're perfectly happy as we are. And so I do think with the Green and women, and what happened there was lots of lesbians and other women converged at this peace camp back in the 80s to protest the nuclear weapons, America's nuclear weapons. And many heterosexual women, some of those that were called miners' wives, which I think is quite a sexist term, the women that were married to miners who were on strike and who were also political activists, decided to go and give the Greenham women a hand with their struggle, because many of the Greenham women had turned up to support the miner strikes. And some of them didn't emerge from those tents the same women as they went into those tents. And so I heard many of those stories. So it doesn't mean that they were always consciously lesbian, or that these terrible Greenham women converted them and told them they had to change sides. It was that if you allow women, and this is, would be the same for men, but if you allow women to really express their sexual desires and orientation without fear of reprisal, without the horror that comes with being told that you're a freak or a pervert, as I was when I was younger, when I came out, and that if you remove all barriers and all social stigma from being a lesbian, of course more women would come out. It doesn't mean all women would come out, far from it. We will always remain a minority, but it does mean if you remove those barriers, more women will think that this is something that they will happily explore for themselves. And for some, of course, this is something that leads them to then, from then on, describe themselves as lesbians. Others might have a little bit of a fling with it, as Julie Birchall once said, a holiday on the wild side. You know, you might want to go to Iceland once, but you wouldn't want to repeat it. So that's why she had a fling with a woman that was momentarily lesbian and then went back to men. So, but I do think if you remove that stigma, more women will become lesbians.
Yeah. I mean, you've said you don't think there's a gay gene, and that, you know, born this way isn't the right approach to make. But I'm intrigued. I mean, that goes on to one of the splits in the book. You say that actually a large, probably a majority of male gay rights campaigners sort of pin that to the mast. It becomes relatively clear, but there is a sort of asymmetry, as you see it, between the situation of same-sex attracted women and same-sex attracted men, and that though your struggle was the same struggle in Section 28, it wasn't before, and increasingly it sort of wasn't after either.
Mm. That's right. And at some stage, thanks to queer theory, I think, and a general disentanglement from the left, because many lesbians and gay men fighting for our rights were on the left. It was the only place that we felt we would be listened to. Then it turned out that queer theory was more dominant, and universities really promoted this notion that everything's a floating signifier, and that queering your identity was the way to go, which of course led to gender identity further down the line. But with the advent of queer theory, lesbian and gay became all one word. And with lesbians disentangled from the women's liberation movement, from feminism, they started to campaign alongside gay men. And I think in particular, the horror that happened to gay men through the AIDS crisis, I mean, not just the death toll, but also the prejudice that was flung at them from politicians and the rest of society and medical professionals was terrible. Many women did join forces with gay men to fight that fight. And so it was set in stone, really, that we would always put ourselves on the back foot and prioritise men. Feminists didn't do that, and lesbian feminists prioritised women and girls, because we're the only movement on the planet that does. But the difference between gay men and lesbians in campaigning, and we saw this through Section 28, is that the dominant narrative of gay men tended to be, generally speaking, look, we can't help it. Be kind to us. It's just like having red hair. You know, we'd really rather not be like this, but we can't help it because we were born this way. So tolerate us. So the word tolerance was used continually. And I think partly that's because gay men lost privilege, lost power in a way by not being with women and being the head of their own families. For lesbians, we gained something. For us, it was an advantage despite the prejudice. And we were proud to be lesbian. We felt that we were the vanguard. We felt that we were cutting edge. And we refused to ask for tolerance and acceptance. And we refused to use the argument that we couldn't help it, we were born that way. Because what we saw was a pride in who we were, and we didn't want to apologise for it. And the gay gene thing, I mean, look, scientists have been looking for this for a long time. Millions and millions has been spent on looking for the gay gene. It's never been found, and it never will be found. And we don't need to ask for our rights on the basis that we are, that our identity is immutable. It hasn't worked for Black people. It hasn't worked for women. It hasn't worked for other groups who were born that way. And so we refused to use it to demand the rights that others had. And so that was a big difference between us and gay men. But, you know, we rub along quite well, and we want an amicable divorce. And I think many gay men want that divorce too, because we'll always support each other on the basis of need. Always, always. And many of my friends are gay men who I love and respect, but we are completely different. We have nothing in common except for being same-sex attracted. And gay men recognise this. And I think it's time that lesbians did, because otherwise we'll just be fighting on the back foot and fighting their issues that don't apply to us.
Do you mean in the sense that particularly one of them is all about a form of male sexuality and the other one is all about escaping from it?
I think that's absolutely right. That's brilliantly put. And, you know, the only way I can describe it really is that, you know, whilst gay men, obviously, and they have absolutely every right to do this and good luck to them, want, tend to, and again, this is a massive generalisation, tend to want loads and loads of sex, often anonymously, you know, with men they'll never see again. And they often, you know, their sexual needs and desires will be fought for before anything else. For lesbians, we take 7 years to break up. You know, with the old joke is that, you know, what do you take on a first date as a lesbian? And it's your cat and your toothbrush. And whilst that's, you know, a fairly funny stereotype, there's something in it. But I do think that gay men have led the charge because they're men. And therefore, their needs are put above ours and they have different needs. So that's why we also need an autonomous, feminist-based movement to say, here's what's happening to lesbians, such as the gender identity issue that has really punished lesbians in recent years. And here's how we need to get out of this mess.
That political aspect to it, you talk very warmly about what sometimes is a threadbare punchline for a joke, this idea of consciousness raising. And I notice it's a point at which you slightly differ from your compadre, Kathleen Stock. Mm-hmm. She gets a slight ticking off for mocking consciousness raising. Why is that? Is that a sort of generational thing, or what's the...
Well, look, I mean, there's 10 years between me and Kathleen, and that often that 10 years is significant. Sometimes it isn't at all. But Kathleen didn't come out in the midst of the women's liberation movement and had a very different trajectory to me. But I think what I gathered when talking with Kathleen about this is that she read that consciousness raising as more similar to today's awful narcissistic identity politics. And it was nothing like that at all. I came into the women's movement towards the end of that consciousness raising period. And why it's not navel gazing narcissism is because because Kathleen's argument is women have always talked to each other. You didn't need feminists to tell them to sit around in a circle and have a chat about what their cervixes look like, that kind of thing. Yes, of course, women had always talked to each other. But before the women's movement raised consciousness around this, which filtered down to women who hadn't been to university, who didn't read books like Shulamith Firestone or whoever, is that they spoke about things that were unspeakable. Child sexual abuse within the home by male relatives, domestic violence, or, and this is something that Cher Height, the only feminist sexologist who wrote The Height Report, a massively successful book that sold millions, which was about women's dissatisfaction with sex with men and their lack of sexual pleasure in heterosexual encounters. Now, these were things that were so difficult to talk about, so embarrassing, really tricky to be able to just go to a woman, a female friend, a Tupperware party and say, have you ever had an orgasm? Or has your husband ever made you feel scared when you don't have his dinner cooked when he comes in from work? That was a near impossibility until the women's liberation movement. And so that's where Kathleen's wrong. And that's where I am right in this. And we've discussed it publicly since. She's looking at what's happening today, and that is nothing to do with what happened in those days with those deep, meaningful conversations that led to political change, led to protest on the streets, led to books that many people read and got a huge amount from, not navel gazing behind a screen, because, of course, it was pre the internet.
Yeah. This is obviously which describes a shift that took place with the rise of gender identity theory, queer theory, you know, the sort of Judith Butler floating signifier stuff. I mean, what's kind of surprising, it tracks that people who were allies suddenly kind of weren't. I mean, you've got, for instance, very warm words for Kath Viner supporting you when there was the argument over this women's refuge in Canada. And she's become, I would say, probably the Guardian editor now for a lot of people in the gender critical camp, you know, let's say not a wholly friendly figure. And likewise, you describe the, and the name is going to escape me, somebody who campaigned to be the head of Stonewall, succeeded Ben Summerskiller as head of Stonewall. Ruth Hunt, yes. And Ruth Hunt had a nice pint with you and said, you know, don't worry, we're not going to cave in to gender ideology, and then probably did exactly that.
That's right. I do have to say, though, I had a gin martini. She had a pint. I just think it's so uncouth. I remember back to the days when women weren't allowed to go to the bar in working men's clubs where my dad frequented. And that stigma stays with me, right? But anyway.
Oh, that's funny. No, I was just, there's a men behaving badly joke about, he asked his girlfriend, "Would you like, what would you like?" She says, a pint. He's like, two girls' drinks in one glass.
I know. It's perfect, isn't it? I love that. But either way, yes. I mean, look, Kath Viner was the main reason that I thought, OK, I can do this journalism lark. Back in the early 2000s, I was working in a university research centre. I was writing op-eds for The Guardian. I then pitched something to her that ended up being a front page magazine piece where I went to Jamaica and researched female sex tourism. And, you know, she was massively supportive with my journalism. I packed in academia. She was a personal friend. And, you know, I wrote across The Guardian. I had a Guardian email address. You know, I was a bit of a Guardianista, which looking back seems a bit odd. Anyway, she then obviously became editor. And in my view, they came after her as a woman harder than they would had the editor been, you know, her rival, Ian Katz. And she decided to cave and not stand up for journalistic principles, in my view. And she became illiberal. And the transactivists came after her and she began commissioning lots of transactivists and no feminist to counterbalance those arguments, everything that a liberal newspaper shouldn't do. And the likes of Ruth Hunt, I mean, Ruth was never a feminist. She was always very ambitious and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But she saw the writing on the wall when she came in to Stonewall in 2015. She saw where the funding was going. They'd already got equal marriage over the line. Legislatively, we were pretty equal to heterosexuals. Really, the work that Stonewall should have done would be to go out and look at gay homeless youth and bullying in schools and the like. But instead, they took the coin for the newly emerging trans activism. And of course, the left has...
You say the coin. Do you see that as... Because, I mean, there's always, on both sides of this debate, accusations of sinister funding and dark money and, you know...
Yes, and actually, if there's any massive dark right-wing money out there for the Lesbian Project or wherever, give it to me, bring it. But there isn't. And, you know, we crowdfund and we raise money through all the usual ways. And with, I think, in terms of the coin reference, The Guardian has really really capitulated to the US desk, who are a load of blue-fringed wazooks, in my view, who seem to think that speaking out against gender identity and male rapists in women's prisons is akin to being Donald Trump. I mean, they just haven't got any decent brain cells operating in their heads. And so, obviously, The Guardian would have lost significant revenue had it not capitulated to gender identity. And with Ruth Hunt and Stonewall, it's obvious when we look now at the crisis in funding, which was documented recently, they've lost a huge amount of money. They have made half of their staff redundant, apparently. And this is clearly because the huge flood of funding coming in for gender and trans issues, you know, has pretty much dried up.
Where was that flood of money coming from? I mean, one doesn't think of an enormous number of very, very wealthy trans people or trans activists having money to spend on that. Why?
No, there are. There are some individual wealthy people that support gender identity and this gender woo-woo. And also, we can't escape the fact that, for example, the Liberal Democrat Party took a lot of donations from Big Pharma, from pharmaceutical companies that have made significant profits from putting young people on a drug pathway. And I know your lawyers will need to check this, so it's all there documented. It's fine. If you want the link, I can send it. And so, look, there's money and also it's political expediency. Ruth Hunt, for example, saw the way the wind was blowing. It was old-fashioned just to be a lesbian. When at a time when they could have started prioritising lesbians for the first time in Stonewall, they decided prioritising lesbians with a penis. And so that's what happened with Stonewall, and the rest is history, because it has significantly impacted on the rights of women, the rights of lesbians and the rights of gay men. And, I would argue, the rights of children who needed support as opposed to transing. So, yeah, there were allies, but the left has long betrayed women on key issues. The left is a disgrace when it comes to, for example, commercial surrogacy or prostitution that they refer to as sex work. And gender identity, they bought hook, line and sinker. And it would appear that the actual proper leftist principles of old, and I no longer consider the Labour Party to be on the left, have fizzled away.
Is that a symptom, do you think, of a kind of wider move in the kind of culture away from the idea of the collective, the idea that you might be in a group, a community, a section of people, be it a class or a sex class or a, you know, group of people banded together by sexual orientation, that you have, you know, you are where you are, and solidarity is the way to achieve political ends? Because there's something about the, you know, it seems almost sort of slightly sort of Thatcherite and consumerist about the idea that you are completely sovereign over your own identity, up to and including whether you're a woman or not, that you're, you know, sex work, again, you're a sovereign individual, there's no kind of collective statement you can make about prostitution and what drives people into it and so on.
That's true. It's neoliberalism and it's very Thatcherite in many ways. Gender identity and the notion that there are pink and blue brains, which is a point that's argued very regularly, is so regressive and sexist. It's so pre-feminist. It's so 1950s. And also the notion that men have these needs. If they're prevented from going and paying for sex how they want with a woman that they've chosen, when they want, they'll blow up, that something terrible will happen to their genitals. I mean, it's a terrible indictment of men. They're saying that men have uncontrolled sexual urges and that all men are potential rapists. It's a terrible attitude to have and very anti-left and very illiberal. But, however, the notion that the problem is an end to collectivism, well, yes, that's true. But then in past 2 decades, at least, I've seen the problems with the idea that you belong to a tribe and that therefore you have to sign up to these sets of beliefs and principles. We've seen it recently with the whole Queers for Hamas stuff, that you have a group of people who believe in gender identity, they believe in the whole sex work and surrogacy thing, and they also believe that Hamas is a liberatory force. And they don't know, they haven't read anything about it, they haven't visited the Middle East or bothered themselves to look at the history of the conflict, but they do believe that they know that they're on the right side of history. So collectivism is a massive problem as well because of people trotting out the shibboleths, the leftists that will not deviate by thinking critically about something that's always been a tick box response. So I do think, I don't want to abandon the left. I think those of us that fight for the rights of women and other marginalised groups, we are the left, and I refuse to consider those that are shouting from the rooftops about how Hamas is a force for good and sex work is work and that trans women are women. They are not my comrades and they are not my friends.
Did you kind of see this coming? I mean, it's what we've gone through in the last 5 or 10 years in terms of the ferocity of this debate and the way it's polarised. Not only it's polarised people generationally, and it's split what would think of itself as the left or the progressive thing. I mean, where do you feel like it came from? I mean, was it just sort of Judith Butler flaps her wings and there's a hurricane on the other side of the world?
Well, Judith Butler and very many other academic grifters that come up with a theory that they then bastardise and for some reason people latch onto as though it's the first idea in the universe. I think that the erosion of any critical thinking through the university system and the higher education system has a lot to do with that, the way that students started to imagine themselves as being contractors, that they were paying for a service rather than engaging in study and in thought. But also queer theory and the advent of the cult of the individual, individual identities, began to grow out of an apolitical depression, I think, where there was nothing left to fight for, nothing left to be communal on. And therefore people started looking out for their own identities. But I did see it some time ago, and I saw it in 2004 when the trans activists came after me. And it was at the beginning of the very beginning, pre-social media, but with listservs online. Do you remember listservs? They were...
dimly.
Right. I mean, it seems such a long time ago because it was. But trans activists had started to get on these groups and listservs, and lots of men posing as lesbians on forums like Ginger Beer, and then dominating the forum and not being kicked off, and then trans activists joining forces with each other and demanding further rights. You know, what more can they ask for? What more can they demand? And the inertia, I think, of many feminists who went along with it, decided to give up, couldn't be bothered anymore. What more can we do? And I love social media and I love the technology that's available to us. And I'm not an anti-progressive when it comes to that at all. And I would disagree very, very firmly with someone like Mary Harrington on this, although she makes some really good points in Feminism Against Progress or Feminists Against Progress? Either way, she's always an interesting writer and thinker. So it's not, I'm not blaming social media for the rise of this, but it's certainly been an enabler. And it's certainly been something that has allowed narcissists to flourish and to meet with other narcissists and to become even more narcissistic. And that is a problem that I've got no idea how to solve except for, and I say this whenever I do public talks or events, is to meet each other. If you can, if you possibly can, and obviously you can't just get on a plane and go across the other side of the world, whereas you can talk to people in Australia online if you're in the UK. But where possible, physically meet with others and talk and plan and just think about the way in which activism and responses to terrible things that are happening flourishes, thrives far more when you're face-to-face with someone than it ever can behind a screen.
Come back to the opening question just to end. I mean, obviously, I guess your book would have been written and completed before the Supreme Court ruling that I'm sure you will welcome wholeheartedly as saying that you are entitled to say that as a lesbian, I don't do dick. but do you think that that represents a kind of end to this period of the trans wars, or do you think it's just the end of the beginning? I mean, is there a detente that can be reached? Because obviously, you know, we cannot ignore that there are many trans-identified people, you know, who equally do just want to live their lives and are, you know, is there an accommodation that can be made, do you think, or a settled position we can end up in?
We were at that accommodation some time ago with the advent of the Gender Recognition Act, which in hindsight, I never would have said it should be repealed, but in hindsight, opened the door to some terrible things happening in law and policy. I think this is the beginning of the end, the Supreme Court decision, but it comes after years of women and some men, but mainly women, having to bring legal cases. And I also brought a legal case against Nottingham City Council for banning me from a public library to do a talk on domestic violence, being hounded by trans activists. But other bigger cases, of course, Maya Forstatter and Joe Phoenix and others, who were forced to clarify the law through putting themselves through hell and major expense. And so that's been happening in the build-up to the Supreme Court decision. And I think that the impact on that has been to show trans activists, and of course most people who live as the opposite sex who are identify as trans people aren't trans activists, don't involve themselves in this tidal wave of misogyny. But what it's done is it's tell trans activists that they can no longer have a guaranteed win every time they force a woman out of a job or a college course, her friendship group, her university society, that they can no longer have a guaranteed win, which they used to when they go after the venues that host our talks on feminism and male violence, that they can no longer guarantee winning when they try to shut down, as they have, a feminist conference where there are 2,000 women expected to turn up 36 hours before the event. All of these awful, awful examples where they have known previously they will win against us because the venue holders and the universities and the employers and the HR departments will all cave into them. What we have said, no, you will not, because we refuse the doctrine of no debate. We will have these debates. The reason why it's took us so long is because the general public haven't been able to hear our side of this because Stonewall introduced no debate at the behest of the trans activist lot. And that is over. No debate is over. So it's the beginning of the end.
Julia Bindle, thank you very much.
Thank you.